To our presiding officer, Speaker Perez and President Albritton, I look forward to working together to advance our shared goals. Now, Speaker Perez represents the busy, fast-paced, modern Miami, the gateway of the Americas, a unique place, not just in our state, but in our country. President Albritton represents the Florida heartland, sometimes overlooked, not by me, but by some, but that has served as the backbone of our state for generations. While coming from different backgrounds, these leaders have a strong desire to make Florida a better place. I congratulate them on earning the opportunity to lead their respective chambers, and I look forward to the days ahead.
So in his State of the State address, of course, that was Tuesday morning, and then that got totally swamped out by the president's speech on Tuesday night. But Governor DeSantis appearing to offer an olive branch or bury the hatchet, please not my back, to Danny Perez and Ben Albritton, the Senate president and the Speaker of the House, and praising not just them, but their people, their lands, their vast tracts of lands, and talking about how wonderful everything is and can't we all just get along, which is a weird follow-up to these raging liberals hate President Trump. That was kind of the tone from a couple of weeks ago. Joining us now, we have State Representative Alex Andrade, District 2, the southern half of Escambia County and just the beachy front areas of Santa Rosa County. I don't know why I said beachy front. Alex, welcome back to the Pensacola Morning News, sir.
Hey, good morning, Andrew, and I like to think that I represent the best parts of the coast of the Gulf of America.
Stop it. Why? Why would you do that? Why? Okay, fine. Anyway, so moving on. Weird tone shift for the government. I mean, not a bad thing. It's good for them to get along, but did he stick his hand in the hornet's nest and realize he had done so and maybe we need to work with these people now?
I think there's a little bit of that. Listen, he's still the governor, right? And that's what I've always tried to like harp on with folks. Like, he's still a great governor. It's not like we don't want to get along. I think he is. He's trying, but you know, there's making like some friendly gestures, and then there's actually internalizing how you interact with us. You know, so the proof will be kind of in the pudding for the next, you know, several weeks about like what is he actually going to be doing differently in interacting with us. I can tell you that there's still some hard feelings on both sides. The governor still harbors some hard feelings about everything and feels like he's been wronged somehow. But he is doing his best right now, at least to, put a charm offensive on for, you know, the leaders of both chambers. And I'll take that as a good sign for now.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than the alternative, at least in my opinion. You had some good news this week, kind of surprising, actually. Your bill to protect the possibility of President Trump having his presidential library be built in South Florida, which, of course, I imagine South Florida legislators would try to thwart, local would. And you've got a bill to preempt them from being able to do that, HB 69. I was surprised by the vote, 13-2, bipartisan support. Did you get Democrats vote for this bill?
A couple Democrats did, and Andrew, I leaned in. I mean, I said this bill should have been numbered HB 45 or HB 47.
Or HB 45-47.
Right. I made no bones about why the bill is filed. And I think ultimately some Democrats do understand, like, a presidential library here in the state of Florida would be a big deal. And so regardless of the fact that they might not like the president, they understand how big a deal a presidential library is for an area. You know what I mean? It would be a tourism draw. It would benefit the community around it. And, if it's on a university, it would benefit the university nearby. So I think, like, ultimately some Democrats, you know, at least at the state level, there are some Democrats who, if they were in Congress, they would have stood up and applauded for that young boy with cancer or something. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like, there's at least a few Democrats who still think rationally and logically about things and don't let emotion win the day every time.
You mentioned about that there are still some Democrats in the state house and the Senate that are, you know, more reasonable. They wouldn't have like gone down in flames like the Democrats in Congress did on Tuesday night. It reminds me of something that Matt Gaetz used to always say back when he was, in Congress and even before that. And I've talked with Matt so many times, but one of the things he always loved about Tallahassee as opposed to D.C. was that you'd play softball with each other. You'd have drinks with each other. You'd eat every other person at the cafeteria, or you'd sit every other person in the committee rooms. And so even though you disagreed about things, you still had meaningful personal relationships with your members across the aisle. Is that still true in Tallahassee today?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, we wouldn't have, we wouldn't have had two members of the Democrat caucus, convert to Republican in the recent months if that weren't the case, if those relationships hadn't already been established. Now, I will tell you, there's obviously some Democrats who do not see me as a human being. but the vast majority of members of the caucus, yeah, we break bread together. We talk. They know they can come to my office and talk with me about, the stuff in my budget that they need help with. And so it's absolutely more collegial than D.C.
Well, I like to believe that you and Anna Eskamani could have a conversation. I'm not sure that you and Michelle Rayner could have a conversation. So we'll just leave it at that. One of the bills or sort of one of the issues that has been a pressing problem for our state, and I know the governor brought it up in his speech. I think Speaker Perez brought it up in his speech, too, was property insurance. And interestingly on this, you and Senator Gates have both co-introduced a bill to work on this issue. What does your bill do? Why do you think it'll work?
Yeah, so all credit goes to Senator Gates on this one. He's the one that brought me the idea. So the bill would require property insurers, before they get their rates approved by the Office of Insurance Regulation in Tallahassee, they'd have to show the profits and losses, the income and revenue of their wholly owned subsidiaries or affiliates in which they own a significant portion, right? So if you own a vendor company, you own 25% or more, 10% or more of that company, you have to disclose that as well, because what we've found out in recent weeks is that even as these property insurers were reporting massive losses to the state justifying rate increases a few years ago, they had these wholly owned subsidiaries or these affiliates that were making extravagant profits from the revenue generated on the property insurance premiums that Floridians were paying, meaning they were hiding their profits, hiding their assets to prove a loss to justify higher rates on Florida consumers. So even though our market is improving, and you notice that distinction, and both can be true, right? Governor DeSantis was celebrating the successes that we've had in the property insurance market as far as like rates stagnating, maybe going down, and our market stabilizing, whereas, Speaker Perez was talking more about like, even though all that's occurring, we still just now discovered massive fraud,
yeah,
or at least indications of massive fraud. And so both of those things can exist, but I'm excited that, the speaker's kind of like digging in on that idea, and this policy proposal, will have some life. I don't know if it'll ultimately be mine and Senator Gates' bill or not, but I know that the policies within our bill are going to become law this year.
Okay. No, and it's discouraging to hear, but I celebrate finding a discouraging fact if it explains a thing that we might be able to solve and it makes sense out of, well, why were the rates so high and why, so it's annoying to find the fraud or the effort to deceive at least, but at least it explains things and maybe that's something that we can fix, like you say, through transparency legislation. So I'd appreciate that. You and I were chatting a little bit about this earlier and before we got on the air, but one of the things that you've started looking at is the number of open positions in the state that are open for a long time. And this is a problem. We see this at local government. I know in Escambia County, it's true as well. But positions that are open, that are budgeted for, but not filled, and how that affects the budget. Can you maybe explain a little bit?
Yeah. So in the budget silo, I control the healthcare budget. I have several agencies like Department of Health and Agency for Healthcare Administration, DCF, and Agency for Persons with Disabilities. But we did an analysis, and I said in my initial draft of my budget, I want to have all FTEs, full-time equivalent positions, meaning like in our budget, we list how many employees we have on the books. On all FTEs that have been unfilled for 90 days or more, eliminated. And what that looks like on my budget right now is 3,589.3 FTEs. Meaning unfilled vacant employment positions, nearly 3,600 in the agencies that I myself control on the state level, that which represent $150 million in in taxpayer funds. So if we were to cut all of those unfilled positions, we'd save the state, you know, $150 million. What we're working through now is how many of those FTEs are somehow like, because what state agencies have done for a long time, Andrew, is if they can't get approval for a pay raise for somebody, they will assign two FTEs to one warm body. And it becomes over time a practice, and it has become over time in Florida a practice of these agencies to do that. And what we're now trying to do is a true up of how many actual warm bodies you're employing and make those, you know, positions equivalent to the FTEs we have on the books, so that one person doesn't represent three FTEs anymore. And we can actually, you know, potentially like leave some of that rate. And by rate, I mean the $150 million, leave some of that behind while getting some of these kind of unfilled FTEs, these fake FTEs off the books, so we can have an actual accounting and estimation of how many state employees we should be employing.
So I think I understand the idea of assigning two or three job titles to a person and giving them pay they don't really deserve, or at least trying to figure out where we stand and how many people we need to actually have. Okay, I get that side of it. The part I don't quite understand, I've always felt a little bit confused by this, maybe you can explain, is if you identify, let's say, 3,500 positions that are unfilled and don't need to be on the books because they've been 90 days without being filled, and we remove those, it seems to me like that's not an actual savings of $150 million because you weren't paying the people, other than these, like, you know, misappropriation examples. It seems like the money wasn't actually going out the door, so how is it a savings? I mean, I definitely want to match up reality with the budget, but how does it save money?
It's going out the door, Andrew.
Oh.
I mean, okay. A lot of this money is going to employees right now. It's just it's not going to employees with FTEs at those approved amounts, right?
It's that widespread? That reappropriation to other people is that widespread?
Andrew, I've been fighting this when I was in control of the TED budget the past 2 years. I've been fighting with the Florida Highway Patrol about this for 2 years. This is a common accounting practice in our state right now, and it's something that we're trying to rein in and fix, because I mean, it is, you don't know which state agency is doing one for one and which state agency is trying to run around on it. And a lot of times it's probably just fudging the numbers. So if we don't have allotted payment amounts for specifically coded FTEs that are accurate to the marketplace, meaning like we can't hire anyone at this amount of money for this slated FTE, We need to fix that. We need to actually do a better job of adjusting that every year, so that we don't have the circumstance where agencies are asking us for FTEs just so they can pay existing employees more.
Wow. Okay, and you say you've been working on this for a couple of years. It sounds like DOGE Florida has been alive and well long before the president got elected. Is that right?
I'm just glad the governor wants to participate now.
I'll leave it on at that. Alex Andrade, he's our state representative for District 2. Alex, thanks for the time. We'll talk to you again next week. We always do this through session where you and I catch up every Friday on what's going on, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Andrew.